Welcome to a panel discussion from the 2016 Traverse City Film Festival. Today, come to the Doc Side with documentary filmmakers from this year's festival. This event was recorded Wednesday, July 27th at the Traverse City Opera House. Now here's your moderator, Rod Burleson.
Well, thank you for coming, everybody. We've got a wonderful panel. I'm the moderator today. Mike's elsewhere at the moment, but I've worked with him for 44 years now on various things, ever since meeting him in his parents' basement to stop the Vietnam War. And also executive producer on his latest film, Where to Invade Next. So thanks. Thanks, guys. We have a wonderful panel today of documentary filmmakers. Andrea Scott, come on up here, from Florence. She's made a wonderful film on prisons, Florence, Arizona. And we have Vanessa Gould, Obit, documentary film, Avia Kepner, and Rosenwald, and she's been making documentary films from Detroit for a long time. Simone Wendell, Things of Kaldstad. We have Fern Perlstein, Dawn Porter, Trapped, and Jesse Nesser, we have also Josh Krigman, Wiener, some of you may have seen that already, and Benjamin Ree, and Magus. Okay, it's a large panel today here. And everyone has a microphone. You should have a water, too, either close to your chair, behind your chair, if you don't have a table next to you. I think what we'll do is we'll start and we'll go down the line here, and we'll introduce each person, and we'll speak a little bit about the films. Jump in if you wish. Anybody on the panel, if you want to add something to what we're talking about here, and we'll talk about all the films. And at a certain point, we'll open it up also for questions from the audience. So, Andrea, why don't you tell us just a little bit about your film? And
So the film is called Florence, Arizona. It is about a small town in Arizona with 9 prisons and the people who live there. And the film sort of, more so than focusing on the inside of the prisons, really focuses on the outside in the town and how it really affects sort of, the people who live there and the energy of the place. And so it's not like a straightforward look at the prison industrial complex, a little bit of a sideways look.
I don't know how many people realize America has more people in prison than any other country on earth per capita or total number. It's become a business. And do you want to say anything about private prisons? When we were in Europe filming prisons there, they couldn't believe there was such a concept as a for-profit private prison who can then take their profits and encourage congressmen, to make laws with longer sentences.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, that is one of the reasons a friend of mine originally told me about this town, and I got really curious, and I started doing research. And one of the things I found was an NPR report about a conference that ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council, had held with private prison corporations, where they, ALEC gets state legislators together with corporations and has them write model legislation. And then oftentimes that model legislation, which is usually beneficial to these corporations, is taken back to the state legislatures, and then these bills are passed. I mean, that is what happened with SB 1070, which was the really horrible immigration, criminalizing immigration, basically, immigrants, rather, in Arizona, that was struck down by the Supreme Court. But this was back in 2010 when I first came across the town. But anyway, yeah, so they, you know, these corporations, these private prison corporations, were trying to incentivize filling these beds and building these prisons. And one of the, there's an immigration detention center in Florence, and immigration detainees were held at some of the other facilities as well, and usually in actually worse conditions than the immigration detention center.
And I just have to say one more thing here. When we did Capitalism, A Love Story, we were taking a look at this whole prison thing, and there was a certain question about could we get the public to feel sympathetic for criminals, who are in prison for committing crimes. And in the end, what we did was we filmed a juvenile for-profit prison in Pennsylvania, where a couple of judges were taking bribes to put children in a juvenile prison, kickbacks over $1 million. So what you've been able to do, I think, is something we were hoping to do. These are adult prisons with criminals, and yet to take a look at how the community is affected by it as well. It's a really cool thing to do.
Well, thank you.
let's go down, let me ask a couple that we have next. Vanessa?
Hi.
And you might have to leave a little early because you've got another screening.
That's right.
This morning. So why don't you tell us a little bit about OBIT? Go ahead. You do it.
Sure. So my film is a documentary about the editorial obituary section at the New York Times paper. And it's not a documentary that I sort of set out to make. It's something that sort of fell on my lap a little bit in terms of my interest in that section. And what ended up happening was a subject in one of my previous films passed away, and the New York Times, at my announcement of his death, ended up running an obituary on him. And he was an unknown French artist. And I started studying the obituary section of the New York Times and became confounded, in fact, that a modern international newspaper would devote pretty powerful real estate to things that were going on 10, 20, 30, 40, 50, sometimes even 60 or 70 years ago. And what ends up happening in that corner of the paper is you sort of see history through the lens of a single person, and the documentary filmmaker in me was riveted. And so the film ends up being sort of a meditation on identity and memory and sort of how we shape our understanding of where we've been.
Wow. So and Mike has seen this film. He says it's very interesting the way you've been able to take the obituary section of the newspaper and make it into a really film that's quite engaging.
Thank you. It was tough. I think a lot of people are sort of worried that it would be moribund or depressing. And what ended up happening, and this was not by design, but there's a remarkable sense of, I think, both innate, resident, and necessary humor for the people that do this every single day. It's turned them into really fabulous subjects themselves, as well as the people that they write about. So there's a little bit of a mirroring thing going on.
Yeah, yeah. And next down the line here, Aviva has made a film, Rosenwald, which, I mean, it's the quintessential untold story. I remember hearing something about this like 20 years ago, and then it just faded from my mind, but an amazing philanthropist. Could you tell us just a little bit about the subject of your film?
Yeah, let me just say, I just had the New York Times bought for me, and of course the first thing I look at is the bits, so make sure you see Vanessa's.
They're really kind of worrying me now, because some of these guys are younger than me. You know what I mean? Does that ever...
Well, if you make historical films, I mean, so many... One was Niederlander today, who started out in the theater business in Detroit, where I grew up, and every time Fiddler on the Roof was there, my dad would take me, which has sort of why I... After thanking the D.C. Bar for flunking me, I became a filmmaker, and absolutely true. And what I do is do films about underknown Jewish subjects, including Hank Greenberg, who's a Detroit Tiger. Yeah, so for you Tiger fans, that's also my film. So 13 years ago this August, I was on the Vineyard, and I heard my hero speak, Julian Bond, who actually is in another film. I thought he was... My film was his last one, but you'll hear about another one that he's also interviewed in. And he started talking about Julius Rosenwald, because I thought he was going to... It was a talk about blacks and Jews. And I thought he was going to talk about, you know, the Civil Rights era and the how blacks and Jews had worked together. But he talked about this man 100 years ago who gave away $62 million. He's the head of Sears and Roebuck, and listened very much to this principle in Judaism, Tikkun Olam, which is something I grew up on. And he, in tandem with Booker T. Washington, built 5,000 schools for African Americans during Jim Crow, and also gave fellowships to people like Marian Anderson, Jacob Lawrence. The list is just endless. And even though it took me 13 years to or 12 years to finish the film, I think today is really the time that we have to look at something like this, where we have to partner. And also the city, the states paid into them too, that we have to have government work with philanthropy, and very much in this case the African-American communities, that we've got to improve our education systems. And this is a very, I think, positive and inspiring film about that.
Education. I think
also
that's...
Also about communities working together, which God knows we need right now.
Yeah.
And... You know, hopefully she'll help once she wins in the fall. Got that in, too.
Yeah. And next, Simone Wendell. Now, let me get this straight. This, you made a film about a small town in Germany, which was the ancestral home of Donald Trump and, I guess, the Heinz Ketchup family.
You need to go back.
But
don't take him.
Which is also part of the story. Actually, they wouldn't take his relative, his grandfather, back. They didn't want him. But you, this is your home too, right?
Yeah, it's my hometown. So, and I'm related, you know, I'm kind of related to Donald, but it's not blood related. And I always told the people when I'm writing the concept, so it's kind of relationship. But the U.S. press always says I'm a second cousin or something like that.
It's a town of like 1,200 people. As a kind of advice to young or, well, any documentary filmmakers, many years ago... You know, Mike said, Michael Moore, he said, you know what? You know, you could probably just anybody could make a pretty good documentary film without, you don't even have to go more than 30 miles from your own house. He said, it doesn't matter who you are. If you look at where you live, there is a story there, and there is a great documentary film there. And you only had 1,200 people. And of course, we were in Flint, Michigan, and it was a bigger town. But, you know, and as we thought back about it, Roger and me, if it was in Rochester, New York, it would have been Kodak. If it was in Elkhart, Indiana, it would have been that Tylenol company. You know, so wherever you live, in your town, there's a great story. And so why don't you tell us a little bit about your film?
Yeah, thanks. So that's also my opinion. I always told people, if you just take a look at things around you, you will find something fun or something that means something to you. And in this case, you know, I'm from Kaltstadt. I grew up there until I was 21. And it's a really small town life. Like, it's going pretty much on, like, singing clubs and women sports clubs, things like that. And I wanted to make a film about that kind of life, that kind of community sense, and that kind of spirit in that kind of small town things. And The good point was to sell the movie is the ancestors from Donald Trump and Heinz Ketchup come from there. So nobody would have ever let me make that film just about life in a village where nothing happens. So, and that was really hard. Even, you know, we shot 270 hours like wine fests and people like having birthday parties. And then when we started editing and then we thought, okay, now we're in trouble. What are we going to do? Nothing happens. But we really felt like that's the right way to make the film. Just we collect everything. I had the feeling I need to, like singing men's club, like drinking, things like that. And then we found the story by editing. But yeah, I always was asked, where's the conflict? And I always told the people, there's no conflict. It's a nice little town. Nothing happens. And in the end, it's somehow, I guess it's entertaining and kind of humorous. And of course, we went to the U.S. and met Donald and talked to him.
Yes, yes. Yes, so there's a wonderful scene that I've seen. Mike somehow has it from somewhere, of when you get to New York in the Trump Tower and you're interviewing Donald Trump, and he realizes that his grandfather, who had left Germany and tried to return, they didn't want him back. They deported him back to America. So it's quite a scene.
Yeah, it's a pretty sad story for the family. And, you know, you also know these Trump things, and he's not interested maybe in these kind of things from his family, but I got to know his cousin. He's a pretty nice guy, and he knows a lot about his grandmother and how it happened in those days. And it was really a tragedy for the family. It wasn't easy to begin in the U.S., but you know, only part of the family realized that.
Okay, let's keep going here. Fern Perlstein, The Last Laugh, which is a Holocaust humor, a Holocaust comedy film. No, I don't know what it is. But what I wanted to stress is it's a Holocaust film, but it's not. You're not going to have any nightmares afterwards. It's not depressing. It's filled with the greatest comics that we have now. Larry Charles among them, one of the you may have seen him if you come to the festival. He's often here. He's on our board of directors and a wonderful comedian. And you can tell some more about who else is in your film.
So I wouldn't call it a comedy, even though it has very comic moments, but only because it's controversial. No, I'm just saying. I like to say it's about taboos and humor and proceeding from the premise that the Holocaust is one of the most off-limit topics, and it opens up to, you know, other things like 9/11, AIDS, slavery, and other things that we have trouble making jokes about, but the focus is definitely on the Holocaust. We filmed Mel Brooks and Carl Reiner and Larry David. We have clips from Larry David. We have, you know, Gilbert Gottfried's in it, Sarah Silverman, Susie Essman. So we show a lot of this humor, and then we follow a 92-year-old Auschwitz survivor who has an amazing sense of humor. I immediately thought of what Vanessa said, that within the Holocaust community, when I would talk to people, and I was so nervous in the beginning, a lot of people would say, oh, there was this funny story or this, you know, like within, sometimes they kept them to themselves, but, you know, humor is a part of survival, and it is a real human instinct. And even in the camps, when we think back to the camps, we say, oh, God, how could anybody have laughed? But when I talk to Renee, who's in my film, we talk about how, you know, she came from a world where, you know, yes, she had to move into a ghetto. Okay, that was her life. Okay, she had to move into here. She went on a train. She went to Auschwitz. She did not know that was necessarily the end. So, you know, when something funny happened or a moment happened, you still laugh. You're living your life. It's just not, you know, we have the idea in retrospect that it's sacrosanct, but you know, when you're, you know, surviving and living through something in any of these issues, you know, people do still have that natural instinct, and it really can be helpful.
When I first heard about your film, you know, Mike was telling me, it made me think of when I was a teenager My father gave me this book to read. It was a little short book. It was Man's Search for Meaning by Viktor Frankl. Anyone ever read it? And it was so much like that. It was how to find. He wrote it. He was a prisoner in, I think, Auschwitz or one of the camps. But the optimism that came out of it, and the meaning that you could find in life in the most difficult situations, like you're talking about, was really meant a lot to me throughout the years.
The original, so a friend of mine wrote this original academic paper that was spurred on by a situation we were in, speaking to a survivor in 1991 about Art Spiegelman's Mouse, and the survivor was very upset about it. I don't know if you know his book. It's known as one of the, maybe the first graphic novel, and it was about his father's experience in Auschwitz, and using animals, so that the Jews were all mice, and
I remember this.
He spoke to the survivor. She was very, very unhappy, and she's like, "You can't, you know, there's nothing funny about the Holocaust. You can't talk about it in the funny pages because the graphic novel was not in our lexicon then."
Yeah.
And we got into a whole conversation with her how actually it's not humorous, it's just a comic form, and it's actually very serious. And the story is intercut with his then present day story with his father, where there could have been funny moments then of him navigating his father and his relationship. And he said to her, "Did you read it?" And she said, "No." So that really stuck with him. He wrote this academic paper. A lot of Viktor Frankl is in that paper. And then that was in 1993, and he handed it to me and said, "Make this into a film." And
wow.
The last laugh.
Wow. Well, thank you. then Dawn Porter. This is an important film, I think, for right now as well. Michigan, we just recently went through some of the trap. They're trying to use trap laws here as well. Why don't you tell us a little bit about your film and the status of availability of abortion in America?
Yeah, my film is called Trapped, and thanks to Fern, it now feels like a comedy. It is about abortion clinics in the Deep South and how there aren't any, so thanks, Fern, for that. I made a film called Gideon's Army that was here about public defenders working in the Deep South. Even though I'm from New York City, I was born in Brooklyn, I got just really interested in the culture there and some political things that are happening. I was traveling in Mississippi, I was shooting another film, and I read that there was one abortion clinic in the entire state of Mississippi, just one left. And I thought, well, that's odd. So I did what any sane person would do. I called them up. That's what documentary people do. We're like, "This is interesting. Can I come over?" And they said, "Yes, you can come over." So literally I just went to, that was the first time I'd ever been in an abortion clinic. And I met this remarkable doctor, Dr. Willie Parker. He's an African-American man, first in his family to go to college, first to go to medical school. And he traveled. He was living in Chicago, and he was flying to Mississippi, Alabama, Georgia, all these states, because there weren't any doctors who would do abortions. And he was a very religious man. He was going to be a preacher. And at some point, he saw women dying because they were trying to do abortions on their own. And he saw women hemorrhaging to death, and he saw all of this like healthcare crisis. And he said, "I think Jesus wants me to provide healthcare. And if no one else is doing it, I'm going to do it." And so he would fly on his vacations and weekends and go south at great personal risk, great personal danger. So I just thought that was, you know, I think when you're a documentary person, you know, what I love about all the topics of these films is something captures your imagination. And for me, it was less about whose definition of morality is right, but it was about why does somebody take on something so dangerous and at such personal risk. He could easily have, coming from a very poor background, become a doctor and had a very lucrative practice and been lauded and given awards. And instead, he was using his vacation time and time off to go help very poor people back where he lived. So I ended up following him for 3 years. One of the things that happened is he introduced me to other clinics where he was working. And one of them ended up being the plaintiff in the United States Supreme Court case that was decided this June. So we followed them until the day of that decision. The film is a film about politics. In America, can some states enact laws that seem to violate the Constitution on their face? What has happened in our political conversation where states are just disregarding the Constitution and not being really secretive about it? So I'm a lawyer by training, very interested in law, but I'm really interested in people. So that's what Trapped is about. It's about the people, how they responded to laws that were closing clinics down. There have been more than 400 laws, anti-choice laws, that have been on the books, also passed by a very conservative group that drafts them and passes them around from state to state. So it's kind of a look behind what's happening.
Yeah, yeah. I'm a little speechless sometimes when I think about this, because I don't know why this is still a debate, you know, in 2016. This was decided so long ago, and I guess it's part of the culture war that has been used. Bonding Wall Street, who I'm sure doesn't really care about abortion, but they've been able to use that as an issue to manipulate the vote, really, I think. I have another question, but let's wait a minute.
I want to help you.
Yeah. I don't know, man. It's just so upsetting. And it's one thing after another, and they've got these, like, little, you know, mean-ass geniuses somewhere figuring out these things that are annoying and making it difficult for women to exercise a constitutional right. It's the whole speech that everybody, I think, has heard, but... You know, you need to be able to control your own body before you have any actual liberty.
I mean, look, I'm pro-choice, but what I really think that this film is about is we have a democratic system, and we should do things in a straightforward way. If you don't like a law, you work against it. You don't go around the system in a sneaky way.
Yeah.
And that's why I say this isn't a pro-abortion film. It's a pro-democracy film, which is if you don't believe in something, you get out there and you make your case to the people. And if the people agree with you, you will win.
Yeah.
And if they don't, you will lose. And then you have to say, okay, I lost.
Yeah.
You know, not everybody gets a gold star. It's not nursery school.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, yeah.
That's what it's about.
Thank you.
This is IPR News Radio, and you're listening to a panel discussion from the Traverse City Film Festival.
Jesse, you've made it. Your film's Detroit-based film, but probably almost entirely filmed in Detroit. Detroit's on sort of a comeback with Midtown and Downtown. Sort of, because Midtown and Downtown are about 5% of the land area, and they're doing very well. But the rest of the town has still needs to be, rebuilt. Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. And I got a great tour of Detroit. I'm not originally from there, so, you know, I was our film Walk With Me, also known as the other movie with Julian Bond. Our movie follows a 94-year-old black federal judge who was one of the first black judges in Detroit. And he was appointed in 1967 at a time where you didn't see a lot of black lawyers, let alone black judges. And as one of the only black judges, he ended up drawing in his first 5 years five unprecedented discrimination cases that dealt with racial discrimination in schools, in housing, in police, in employment, and in one case that dealt with the whole national security versus civil liberties debate. And at the time, you know, these lawsuits were, no one had ever sued for these rights before. Equal employment and the right to have, that a school that's predominantly black should have more white students and a school that is predominantly white should have more black students, and that a police force, God forbid, should be somewhat reflective of the community that it's serving. And these were all cases that Judge Keith drew and were sort of the first lawsuits of their time, and here's a black judge who draws them, one of the few in Detroit. In a five-year period, his first 5 years on the bench, a former World War II veteran and janitor who fought the system enough to be able to get a law degree and get mentored by Thurgood Marshall and end up being appointed by Johnson in 67, 3 months after the riots. So that's the background of our story, and our movie follows his life growing up in 1920s Detroit all the way to now, where he's 94 years old and still a federal judge, one of the oldest judges in America on the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals. And he's someone who, just by nature, if you're going to cover a guy who's 94 years old, you're inevitably covering the last 100 years of U.S. history. Yeah. And our movie has World War II in it and the Detroit riots. And we did the math the other day. Judge Keith has been alive for over a third of our country's history.
Wow.
And
wow,
that's a lot to have someone like that who is articulate and working and able to tell his own story,
yeah,
his own words, when so many civil rights leaders have passed before a movie could be made about them.
Yeah.
That was our motivation to make this movie.
Well, it's a wonderful thing. And I had forgotten that Lyndon Johnson appointed him, at a time when, that wasn't done. But the poor guy got mixed up in Vietnam, and otherwise he would have been.
Well, after the riots, there were a lot of pressure to, get more black representation out there in Detroit. And in the film, we tell the story about how Judge Keith and John Conyers, who's the longest serving congressman in U.S. history, still serving, how the
still
two of
serving.
Them drove downtown and fought their way into City Hall, and they were the only two black people there in a whole leadership community trying to decide what to do about the riots. Not one single black person was there until the two of them, got into the building and played a part in deciding what to do about those riots.
Well, I had no idea. The film does bring forth so many things we didn't realize about that period. And those of us that grew up in that area or were in Detroit, during the 67 riots, we remember vividly and remember the 101st Airborne returning from Vietnam, returning from combat, really... The city became, I don't know what to say, a war zone.
I think Detroit's the only city where federal troops have had to been called twice for a riot.
Was the other one 44?
43.
43.
Which he was at that in 43, he was someone who, he was young enough where his mom told him, you don't go outside. He wanted to, and so he lived through the 43 riots wanting to do something. Only 33 years later, to end up playing a part in the 67 riots.
Wow.
Can I?
Yes.
I grew up at 7 Mile, Livernois, so the riots were in literally the street right behind us. And I'm a child of a Holocaust survivor, and I remember there was a new book out that week or that month called Sobibor Uprising, and I'm reading it while the riots are going on, and I totally got it.
Yeah.
At that time. Yeah. But are you sure it's the only federal troops? Because in my extras with Rosenwald in 1919 was the Chicago riots, and I'm pretty sure troops were also brought out.
No, troops are brought out, but Detroit, I think, is the only city where troops are brought out twice.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah.
Not a great record.
Well, yes.
It's called Walk With Me, The Trials of Damon J. Keith.
Yeah, it's a wonderful film. And so, Josh Krigman, Wiener.
Yeah. But
usually it gets pretty...
Enough said.
It's a sophisticated group here, because, you know, sometimes all you got to do is get up and say, Wiener, and, you know...
it makes Q&A's pretty easy, actually, usually, yeah.
But it's a wonderful film about politics and democracy and privacy, and it's well-filmed. Can you tell us, maybe,
the audience? I think as you all, many people probably remember, Anthony Wiener was a congressman, sort of a rising star in the Democratic Party, who got into some trouble when he accidentally tweeted a picture of himself, of his wiener, to a woman. He intended it as a direct message, but he accidentally posted it publicly for all 40,000 of his Twitter followers. And so that was the beginning of his infamy, and he ended up resigning, and then a couple years later running for mayor of New York City in an effort to redeem himself and get back into politics. And that's when our film really begins, is following him through the course of that mayor's race a few years ago now. And it is about Anthony and his story, of course, but it's also a broader story about politics and media as you sort of see things unfold. It's one of those political stories that I think a lot of us saw at the time. And I think this happens, I think this is something maybe is familiar to us today. You see these things happening and you're just thinking, what the hell is going on here? And so it does, I think, have some, you know, relevance to some of what we're seeing unfold in front of us now. And then I also want to say that the, you know, one of the challenges of the film opportunities really was, it is on some level a sad story about somebody doing some damage, obviously, to his life, but it's also, there's an incredible element of humor involved, and that was something that we worked with very closely in putting the film together. And Michael Moore's film certainly inspired me, you know, both just in the reality of his films inspired me, but also I remember reading some advice that he wrote a number of years ago, somewhere in the middle of our edit, about remembering as documentarians that we're making movies and trying to encourage us to put the documentary word aside and to remember that we're trying to make something that's entertaining. And I think, and I was curious, Rod, whether you could verify this. I think he said
he has a
sign above his... Is that it, Sweet? Is that right? That says...
Oh, well, one sign says, in the editor's room, I think, one of the little signs above the editing machine is always been, remember, after seeing this movie, people are going to want to go home and have sex.
Right.
In other words, you know, you need a movie that's entertaining first. You need a movie. Otherwise, if no one sees it, your message won't get through.
So needless to say, that was inspiring to me through the course of
the day. One of the questions we've gotten the most often with you is, you got an awful lot of very intimate footage with Mr. Wiener. How did that happen? I mean, with his family as well.
Yeah, I mean, so I came to the story because I actually worked in politics. I worked for Anthony when he was in Congress. I was his chief of staff for a couple of years. So I knew him well professionally and personally before his scandal. So it was, you know, we stayed in touch over the years after I had left politics and moved into filmmaking. And then it was after he resigned and when he was gearing up to run for mayor, that he agreed to allow me in to really be by his side through the course of the mayor's race and film just about everything. And it was the result, actually, of a couple years of conversation of me pitching him this idea of telling his story in a way that could really kind of get past the punchline version that he became and sort of show a more complete picture, no pun intended.
Yeah. There's so many puns available here.
Yes, and his wife is Huma Abedin, who is a very high-level, who works for Hillary Clinton very closely. So she's the vice chair of Hillary's campaign now.
Hillary Clinton's personal assistant for, 20 years maybe?
Yeah, I mean, she's one of the handful of closest and highest advisors in the campaign, which, of course, leads to all kinds of parallels.
Yeah. It's an entertaining film, and it fulfills, as Mike says, that you want the movie to be entertaining. At the end here, we have Benjamin Rhee on the end of our who's made a film, Magnus. about playing chess, but very engaging. Would you like to tell us a little bit about how you made it?
He's from Norway. You don't need to know anything about chess to watch this film. It's really about the human drama. It's about family. Magnus Carlsen, he's the highest rated chess player of all time. He's a chess genius, and we've been filming him for a decade. And what's really special about Magnus is that, you know, chess is regarded as the touchstone of intellect, kind of the ultimate battle of the minds. And throughout history, the best chess players in the world have learned chess through discipline, having a strict teacher, especially kind of the Russian chess school, working really, really hard. And Magnus, he has never done a chess homework his whole life. He has done everything voluntarily, and his way of learning chess throughout his childhood was that he picked up a random book and opened it on a random page and read it, and then he started reading Donald Duck, and then he played some sucker, thinking about chess all the time. So Magnus has taken a completely different path. And when he actually was 13 years old, Garry Kasparov, which probably some of you know, the great Russian chess player, he said that to Magnus's parents, "The apple is almost rotten." About, you have to teach this boy to have discipline, to learn chess in a disciplined way, or else you will waste the potential talent. And Magnus continued to learn chess his own way. And that made him an intuitive and creative chess player. And he has revolutionized chess. And this is what's fascinating me about the story, is that it's bigger than itself. It's like when computers came along in the chess world, Magnus tried to avoid computers. All the other chess players uses computers to prepare for chess. Magnus doesn't. And Magnus, I remember going with him to Harvard University. He was playing the 10 of the best chess players there, blindfolded simultaneously. And he beat all of them, 10 of the best chess players. And that's also a scene we have included in the film. But again, the film is about...
Why was he blindfolded?
He sits like this, with a kind of blindfolded, and the chess players are behind him, and a person goes and he says the moves right, pawn to b3, and then he remembers everything. Everything is in his kind of in his head. Okay. That tells a bit about his genius. So this is a and also there's so much footage. We had 500 hours of footage. You can tell the story in present tense, the coming of age of a genius. It's like following Mozart. He's called the Mozart of chess, following him for 20 years. And that's been really fascinating to see how this genius became so good.
And since we're down at the end here, and this changes the subject a little bit, but we were talking backstage, and I know that all documentary filmmakers struggle with this, and that's financing your film. How could you just tell us a little bit about how your film was financed?
Yeah, we are very fortunate in Scandinavia because we have a government funding system. So 70% of the film is funded by the government.
70%.
Yeah,
that's the same as the rest of us.
Yeah, and that made it possible actually because it was. We used a year to edit this film. We were two editors and me. I was also editing. And it took a year because chess is introverted. And to try to make chess entertaining in a visual media, you know, is extroverted. So to try to kind of convert the emotion so we can feel what Magnus is feeling, that was a huge challenge. So we used a year only in the editing process to make it work. And the government made it possible to do that.
We financed Roger and me by running a bingo game every Wednesday night at the Karuna, you know, strip mall there north of Flint. And we could get a few $100 and then buy two or three rolls of 10-minute 16-millimeter film, and that would last us, for a little while. But I know many, we don't have so much of that in America. And the government does this. It's just your federal government. And then if you told me also, if the film does well, the government will give, besides whatever ticket sales and other revenue, the government then, and maybe they're doing this in Germany as well, but the government will give you additional money for every 10,000 people. You get so much money or something.
Yes, in Norway, if the film is watched by over 10,000 people, the company will get 100,000 euros.
I'm moving to Norway.
No, you got it backwards. The first thing you told me it was 100 euros.
Sorry?
It's 100 euros for every 10,000 people?
No, it's not. But that's kind of that's 10,000 people is the first kind of limit, and then it's not another 100,000 euros next time. No.
Here the government
you get money
makes
based
you pay
on
them $100,000 for every person who
but
watches
that,
your movie.
You know, Norway is such a small country, and that makes it possible to finance investigative journalism, and it makes it possible to make a lot of documentaries. And in Norway, we watch a lot of documentaries in theaters. And that's because of the funding system.
I kind of disagree. I think a big, wealthiest country in the world like us could do a lot more to help documentary filmmakers. Who every one of these things are ideas and things that the standard media is not going to bring forward. All these, and they're so important, you know, philanthropy, abortion, prison. So I just wanted to make my pitch here. that we do need to, we all benefit from paying our taxes, and one benefit we should receive is greater support of independent filmmakers like the people here on the stage. Yes, sir. Thank you.
So you know there's bar mitzvahs and bat mitzvahs for Jewish kids, so I call two of my films my bat mitzvah films because both of them took 13 years to raise the money. Now, I also did other things. I started a film festival. I write. So I have a 501c3. And the reason I'm saying this publicly is if you all want to go into filmmaking, it's harder with historical because there's a lot of footage you have to buy and a lot of working. And it goes back to the other subject you said. And I once had an exhibitor tell me that if you make people laugh and cry in your movie, they're going to love your movies. And I think I agree with Michael that it's really important that even though we make docs, that we can make them entertaining.
Yeah, absolutely. It's the first thing he always says. I might have heard him say it 1,000 times. When if he were here, he would be saying it right now. The first thing to do is to make a movie that people want to go to on Friday night and then have sex afterwards. I mean, he says that over and over. And our films do exactly what you've said, Aviva. They try to let people laugh and cry, both, and have an emotional experience in a group, in a dark room, in a group of with a lot of other people that have come there for that, you know, gathered together in a community situation, not at home on a TV screen. And so the theatrical release and the distribution is really important. Let's see. I think let me check the time here. We can get some questions from the audience now. I think we're set up for that or not. Okay. Let's if you'd like to ask any of the filmmakers here a question about their film or what they've done or how they managed to do this, raise your hand. We've got a microphone coming out. Someone will come out and you can ask a question. For any of us up here. There's one back here. Okay, I'm right here.
This is for Andrea. Your movie about the prisons in the small town. Because I didn't get tickets for your movie. Was there a difference in how all of these prisons affect the actual social structure of the town? Because we've got, you know, a town whose major employer is a prison. And how does that affect the people?
Yeah, so I mean, the town itself, the population of the town is 25,000 total, or something like that. But it's The breakdown is basically two inmates for every one civilian. I think it's 8,500 civilians to 17,000 inmates. The town, because all of those numbers are included in their census. So the way it works in Arizona is there's something called state shared revenue. And so the town, and you get money back based on how many people are living below the poverty level, and all the people in prison are considered as living below the poverty level. And so they get a ton of money back from the government for these inmates. And so so the town's coffers are quite full. And they do things that, you know, they build things that they don't need. Like, I think they just built a new library and a new pool, even though they had, like, perfectly functioning ones before. One of the things that I found sort of most interesting on my first trip there was I thought people are going to, like, have something real to say when I ask them, like, what's it like? Like, how are you affected? Like, how's your life affected by living in a prison town? But they were all like, there's nothing. You know, like, I like to think of it as, like, a little bit of a microcosm for how we as a nation think about our prisons. I mean, they really are so often right in our backyard, as they are in Florence, but we don't want to think about them, sort of like out of sight, out of mind, even in a town where there are nine of them. That question that I thought would have be answered right away became something that I had to really investigate a little deeper and try to tease out, maybe not super literally from people, but tease it out in how they respond to other things in their life.
I have a question for Aviva. I saw your film in Detroit, and you were speaking about trying to get funding to show this film in schools, and I wondered how that was going, because it's such an inspiring film for young people.
Boy, and I didn't even plant this question. What happened is we've gone back to, I always overshoot, so I got a Ford Foundation grant, and there's 3 hours of extras, a lot more stories, both from the Black and the Jewish point of view, mostly the African-American historical point of view. It was based on the fact that I had all these young interns for years, African-American and white, and no one knew who Marian Anderson was. And I thought, oh, my God, this is even bigger than I thought in terms of lack of education. And also an older white woman came to me in a screening in California and said, I learned more tonight than I ever learned in school. So I decided that I had a responsibility to spend another year. So I have enough to do the extras. And the Spielberg Foundation just gave me money for the teaching guide, because the DVD that will come out by the end of the year will have the film broken up in parts for teaching and then these 3 hours of extras. So now I'm trying to raise corporate money, because what I really want to do is get it in every school system, junior high, high school, college, all over, you know. So if you have any suggestions, come and see me after. And that's the next move. Once we have all the extras, and including the Chicago riots, which actually Julius Rosenwald was on the committee for it. But the really interesting thing is that he and the mayor of Chicago prevented Birth of the Nation being shown in Chicago, while President Wilson was showing it at the White House and saying this is the greatest film. That's the original Birth of the Nation. There's going to be one coming out that was just at Sundance. It's a different, obviously, take on it.
Well,
to your left.
I've got a question for Josh Krugman. You made an oblique reference to this, the marriage between Huma Abedin and Anthony Weiner. I wonder if you could give us any insight as to, I know everybody's wondered why Hillary stayed with Bill, why she stayed with him.
You have to watch the movie. I guess that's a good plug for the film. I don't know. I mean, it's a question that people kind of, I think, naturally want a clear answer to. I think part of what you see when you watch the film is you get to kind of be with them through this experience, which I don't know if people know, but the mayor's race was originally, he was doing very well, and then the new revelations from his scandal came back, and it became a real circus, or it was a circus kind of throughout the whole thing, but it ended up being obviously a very unsuccessful and kind of disgraceful effort to get back into politics. And you, the film allows you to experience alongside him and really with both of them, kind of, you know, in the room with them through that experience. And part of what I think you see is that kind of our natural desire to have the clear answer or the, you know, the kind of soundbite version that kind of satisfies the, you know, the why question about marriage, about human nature, about all these things is it ends up, I think, feeling a lot more complicated than you might think. So, you know, they have a relationship, and I think it's hard to say, you know, from outside any relationship what's going on inside. Exactly.
You know, you did get a lot of very intimate footage, though. You had obviously somehow gained their trust, and you were in the room a lot with both of them.
Yeah, no, I mean, you know, I obviously had known Anthony for a long time, and, you know, I think he and was kind of hoping for and committed to this idea of having a more a complete version of his story told in the same way that I was. And so he really allowed me to film everything. I mean, not everything, but a lot. And it is a little bit, I think it's a little bit surprising, certainly for viewers, to kind of be in the room with him and with his wife while these things are happening.
One more?
I have a question for Dawn. You mentioned that you see your film as a statement for democracy and about letting the people decide, but oftentimes in history, some of our best advances in civil rights, including abortion rights, have been because the courts decided things that the general populace wasn't ready to vote on or to make the correct decision on. So how do you and your film and personally reconcile that notion that going around democracy can sometimes be just as powerful a force for good as it can be a reactionary one?
I should clarify. By democracy, I didn't mean a popular vote, although the truth is Americans consistently and have consistently since Roe v. Wade polled in support of abortion rights. So I think if you were to put it to a popular vote, there wouldn't be actually any question. We have a very vocal anti-choice minority. What I meant more is respect for the rule of law. And so my personal view as a lawyer and person who practiced for 10 years is that these laws violated our constitutional principles. So what I mean by respect for law is respect for the democratic process in that we had a Supreme Court, we had cases litigated. Even though the Supreme Court decided 5-3, that these laws, the Texas law was unconstitutional. They're laws that target abortion clinics for regulation that does not apply to other medical procedures that are similar. So you can go to get a colonoscopy, you can get plastic surgery, you can go to your dentist where you're put under, and you're not subject to the same regulations as abortion clinics. So that's more what I meant. But I clearly, you know, if we don't have the Supreme Court making decisions that might be unpopular in parts of America, a lot of people who, you know, have minority rights would not be protected. So,
thanks for coming today. If you see these films, you enjoy them, tell your friends, put it on Facebook. Thank you so much. It's some terrific films, and for your time and for coming all this way.
Thanks. You've been listening to a panel discussion from the 2016 Traverse City Film Festival. You can hear the entire series of panels at interlochenpublicradio.org. I'm Linnea Melkerrick. Thanks for listening.